A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. Here's your host, Tom Bourne.
Hi, and welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. I'm your host, Tom Bourne, and today I'm joined by the marvelous Andy Shon. Andy, how are you?
Doing good, thanks, Tom. Glad to have the opportunity to catch up and have a chat.
Now, you're based in the lovely Gold Coast, and where the weather is always beautiful, I believe.
Oh, we have our moments, but as I always say to people, wherever I go in the world, someone's got to be based on the Gold Coast, and fortunately for us, it's us.
Has it always been the Gold Coast for you, though?
Yeah, I've been in Australia 14 years now, give or take. Oh, it's just gone past 14 years, I think, and for the most part, aside from a few months at the very start in Melbourne, it's been all on the Gold Coast, yeah. Mm. Yeah, very fortunate.
Why did you leave Melbourne? I've got to ask.
Yeah, it might not be very popular with Victorians or people who are in Melbourne, but when I first came to Australia, Melbourne wasn't really what I had in mind. Well, it's not what you imagine as a park. It's not what you imagine of Australia, Melbourne. I was from Manchester, and Melbourne had some vibes which are somewhat similar to Manchester, actually, especially the weather some of the time. So the Gold Coast is a bit more like it once I came up here, which is where my wife is from as well. She's from the Gold Coast. So once we got up here, I was like, oh, yeah, this is what I had in mind for Australia. So, yeah, it was a good move.
Has this year been a typical Queensland winter, you know, happened on a Tuesday and then was gone?
No, we've had a beautiful winter this year, actually. Yeah, it's been great. Very, very dry has been the only downside. Where I live in the Crumbin Valley, we've had bushfires already this year, which is quite something for so early in the year. But aside from that, it's been great.
All right, Andy, I know a little bit about you through seeing you professionally on LinkedIn and seeing some of the work you've been involved in. But for those who don't, can you tell us a little bit about your professional journey so far?
Yeah, sure. I'll try and give it as much as possible a short route, but I actually started out in banking back in the UK, which when I came out here, I thought, well, that's not going to be very useful to me in the career I ended up moving into. But looking back, there's lots of lessons that I did learn from banking, more around things like organizational culture and the failures of risk management and all these other types of things, which I've actually brought forward into my, I said, you want to call my career too, which has been in safety. So in Australia, 14 years with Southpac Group, originally just with Southpac Aerospace, which is the original part of our business. So I kind of got into safety through aviation safety, which was obviously a really fascinating area to get involved in. Grew up around aviation. Before I went into banking as a kid, I was always going to be a pilot, right? So many kids grow up, I want to be a pilot when I grow up. So I already had this fascination with aviation, and a family had a background in aviation. So when I fell into aviation safety, that was great. But that was also where my real introduction to safety came, which in aviation is a strong bias towards SMS and James Reason and Patrick Hudson and a lot of work that was done in the, I guess, 80s and 90s, which aviation's very much taken and run with. But then we also established a certification body about 10, 12 years ago, SOUTHPAC certification. So very much across the management systems side of things and third-party auditing and all that. So I've done more audits than I could even count, I think, especially in those early years. And then we launched SOUTHPAC International and the Hot Lab. Once I really started to get really excited about some of this new stuff that was coming along in like that kind of 2015, 2016, the Deckers, the Conklins, the whole Nagels, all the usual stuff you'd expect to need to talk about. And then that's kind of took us in a different direction as well. So we've got a whole diverse team of people here now who are doing stuff, obviously, in aviation safety and in certification, but also but a lot of my passion lies in that kind of hot kind of area. So hopefully that's a reasonable nutshell.
It is good. For those who may have been living under a rock since, as you said, about 2015, what is HOP and why does it appeal to you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll come to the first one first around, sorry, the second question first around why does it appeal. I think a lot of the kind of criticisms of traditional safety that have been made, some would say fairly and some would say unfairly, I kind of recognized a lot of those sorts of criticisms and I kind of started to see some of that myself in the things that we were doing, where there was this kind of a noticeable focus on bureaucracy and paperwork and rule adherence and compliance. And not to say there's not a place for all of those things. I think it has to be a balanced conversation, right? But I think when that was particularly some of the very outspoken people, I think when Decca started talking about the kind of this kind of almost at this paradox of safety differently versus all this other terrible stuff that we're doing in safety. For some people, that completely turned them off. And for other people, that really grabbed their attention. For me, it really grabbed my attention. Now, I didn't want to say I fully agreed with everything that was being said, but I felt like it was needed, this sort of challenge to kind of, hey, we need to really evaluate what we're doing and why we're doing it. So for me, it appealed. And I think as a professional, you should always be looking to try and grow and develop and try and be as innovative as you can be. So it just appealed, I guess, in that respect. But then that began for me a long journey of really starting to explore what does this mean in practice, which is I think where we started with SOUTHPAC International and HOP. It was a lot of academic work and a lot of people talking about it, not so many people really trying to operationalize it, I guess. So that was where the appeal came from. For me, what is HOP all about and what's the new view all about? For me, it's almost easier now to define what it is by saying what it isn't, because I think there's been so much, I think, unhelpful stuff that's been said about the new view approaches. For me, it's not this is carte blanche to throw away everything we've ever done in safety. And I think there was a lot of that, particularly early on, maybe what you might call the radicals or the zealots, I think have been quite unhelpful to the message and to the cause, really. I think it's about balancing and taking a reasonable perspective between acknowledging the things that we've done in the past that have been helpful, maybe what you might call traditional safety, safety one, centralized control, what term you want to use. I think it's about saying, yes, we need that, but it's not sufficient. And then if it's done in excess, it can become damaging to us. So it's about how do we balance that with some of these more, maybe what we call new view approaches. Some people don't like that term either, but it's how do we build in this ability to really kind of tap into A, the collective knowledge and insight of our people, getting the most from that adaptive capacity, which I think is critical for success. But it's doing that and doing that in a way in which it's not a one or the other. It's got to be done together. And that's where I think some of the messaging's got lost over time.
Yeah, more of a measured approach, I'd suggest. It's funny, you talked about it, the revolutionaries and the radicals, and I never thought about that, but it does follow that path whenever you have a significant movement arise, and that you do have the radicals and the revolutionaries who start the process. And they generate a lot of attention, good or bad. But I think most of the time in history, it's never really the revolutionaries who end up finishing the revolution.
So you're saying some of those earliest people, that they're like the Robespierre of the French Revolution. They're there in the vanguard, but they end up being deposed and replaced.
Absolutely. And I think that they've actually become fairly big targets because of what they've said. It's given people a real opportunity to push back, some more conservative people to push back on some of their ideas, or just to basically imply they're impractical or can't be implemented easily into the workplace.
I think there's been quite a bit of bad faith on both sides of the argument. There's plenty of it to go around, I guess, in terms of some of the new view theories have been kind of set up in terms of opposition, maybe not intentionally, but some more than others, against other more traditional approaches. And I'm not sure if that's being helpful. And I think it comes across then as being disingenuous when you create a straw man of what safety is currently, then you just beat the hell out of that and say, that's so terrible, and here's a better way of doing it. I think some people have seen through that or just been quite upset by that. I said, well, I don't recognize that picture you're painting. That's not the way I've been doing safety anyway. So, you know, to hell with your ideas. And I think that's kind of to be expected in some quarters. So yeah, the approach we take when we talk about HOP, we always kind of try and, again, I think it's more of a nuanced conversation. It's like, okay, some of the things that we've done up until now have been really helpful to us and have helped us get where we are, but some of the things have probably not been so helpful. And some things, let's just face it, we all know is a waste of time. But it's about then having that conversation to say, well, what are the things that we build on and what are the things that we want to try and reduce or just manage? And I think most people, when you present it that way, have a way more considered approach, and they recognize some of the problems, and then they're open to opportunities about how might we do some things differently and what might be some of the new things that we introduce. So I tend to find these days that we get very, very few people, maybe more so in the past, but very few people now who get upset about but I think it depends on the approach you take. I think we want to try and take people on the journey with us, not browbeat them for things they maybe we considered done wrong in the past.
Yeah. I put my hand up. I may have in the past foolishly ridiculed certain other beliefs openly before I suddenly went, you're not really helping the conversation, Tom, by just pushing your point of view and trying to ram it down people's throats. When we've had generations of people who, that's what they've been taught, that's what they've been made to believe is true. And I think sometimes we have to understand that it's probably going to take a generation or two before we can actually move past, you know, several generations of what people have learned.
I think one of the things that we talk a lot about local rationality and in HOP, and I guess all new view approaches, we talk about local rationality and context driving behavior. But then we don't always necessarily stop and think about how that applies to safety professionals and people who are doing things in safety, in terms of, well, the things they've been doing up until now have made sense to them for probably a whole range of different reasons. And oftentimes we don't stop and critique what we're doing and think, why am I actually doing this? And is it the right thing to be doing? Well, we think, well, the organization's doing it and every other organization's doing it. And that's obviously must be a sensible thing to do. And oftentimes we have very convoluted and bureaucratic systems that are driving that activity. And it's easier said than done sometimes. You say, oh, yeah, just step out of all of that and do something differently. So it does require us to kind of the things that we talk about and things that we teach, we have to practice and apply that as well in how we approach other people and the things that they're doing.
Someone asked me the other day, they said, what's your aim in, what's your actual aim in safety, Tom? And I said, I've moved past my own personal opinion sort of point of view. And now I just want people to actually think about the measures they take in relation to theirs and other people's safety. And if they can come up with a solution that suits them, but they've actually thought about it instead of just, well, this is the way we've always done it, or this is the new thing that's been foisted upon me, I'm happy because I think you need workable solutions, as you said, local level context. It makes a lot of sense. But just with you, Andy, you mentioned that lovely term safety earlier. What is safety? What's the Andy Schoen definition of safety?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because it's one of those foundational questions that we spend so much time talking about. And I can probably lean on a bunch of different definitions, and I think a lot of them have a lot of merit. I was thinking of the ICAO definition, and it's a situation where the hazards have been identified and the risks have been managed to a position as low as reasonably practical. I think, well, that's a reasonable starting position because, you know, that is at least part of our role, right? To recognize things that can go wrong and ensure that those things have been controlled. So that's perfectly valid. I just don't think it's sufficient. And that's where I think where those kind of more new view sort of definitions come into play. It's not just about that. I think that has to be part of the conversation, but it's also about ensuring we have sufficient capacity in order to be successful. And that's the kind of more that safety two perspective. You know, we live in a variable world. We can never, ever see reasonably the true amount of variable possibilities and emergent outcomes and so on. So we also need to build in this ability to be able to adapt and learn and adjust in real time, relying on the insights and the knowledge of people who are doing work every day and all those sorts of things. So I think there is any pragmatic and sensible safety professional has to always be seeking to try and balance those two different imperatives. So, you know, our more traditional approach, we are in the business of keeping people safe and ensuring bad things don't happen. But it's how we go about doing that. And obviously, it's combining the more traditional approaches with some of these newer insights. So I kind of weaseled out of that one, didn't I? But
it's all right. It's all right. It's a complex question. It's a deceptively simple question. But I think if you've got five safety professionals in a room and you got them to write down what their definition of safety is, you get at least five different definitions.
And I think all of the answer I just gave you doesn't even turn or address really how it feels to be safe or to be unsafe. What we just talked about is around more definitions, which again are more about things going wrong or things going right, but that doesn't address the other softer aspects of safety. So it's a the more you dig, the more there is to potentially to consider and think about.
Yeah. Just a curious, just while we're on your view of the world, are all incidents preventable?
It's a loaded question, that one. So always in hindsight, yes. There's never anything which isn't preventable after the fact. I remember being at a conference some years back, and this isn't a personal kind of attack on any one person, but this speaker made a comment at this conference, and they were talking about Deepwater Horizon, you know, Macondo, and they were talking about it, and then they made this comment, as has now been confirmed by Patrick Hudson, the event was preventable. And it was like, for me, I just sat there and thought, why do we have to defer to Patrick Hudson to say this event was preventable? It's like, well, after the fact, of course it was preventable when you look back and say, well, if only they'd have done this and they could have done that and they should have done this. But everything always looks so straightforward, doesn't it, after the fact? So that's not to say there aren't things which maybe we could be better at, and you think, well, maybe things that should have been in place had been in place, it wouldn't have happened. But then that doesn't allow for, in complex environments, you know, where we have emergent outcomes where no one could have reasonably foreseen how those kind of different variables would come together. So no, unfortunately, I think we're destined to be in a world where things will always continue to go wrong. It's a complex, messy world. And as much as we want to try and overlay order over that and kind of imagine we can control all these potential outcomes, I think that's more us as humans wanting to feel like we can have control over some of these things that maybe are less controllable.
Yeah, excellent. Have you always been interested in safety topics?
No, not. I'll be honest, I was not necessarily interested in safety before I got involved in safety, but I was very interested in I guess what now would call maybe organizational psychology, the way organizations kind of behave and things that happen in organizations and the reason why things happen and the way people behave within systems like that. I mean, having a relatively close up view to some of the things that were going on in the banking industry back in the UK in the 2000s, and then seeing things like the Royal Commissions and various different government investigations into the banking industry, looking back and being able to recognize all of those types of, I guess what at the time was called misconduct, and it was very much to blame the worker, right? It was a kind of all these terrible people working in this system who were doing this and doing that. But the whole system was geared and rigged to create the outcomes it created. So whether it's in the UK where we had the payment protection insurance scandal, I worked in a branch network. Fortunately, I wasn't in a position where I had to sell PPI insurance because I was in business banking, but I saw it up close what that environment was like, where you create this vast amounts of pressure every day on everyone working in that branch network to try and sell a product, whether the customer needed it or not, would benefit from it or not, or sometimes even if they knew they'd bought it or not, it was like that was immaterial as long as you're getting the numbers. So you create a system with enough pressure and enough incentives and, you know, enough kind of deficiencies and weak safeguards and all the rest of it, those outcomes are almost inevitable. So from that perspective, I take that kind of learning, and you see that in organizational life today, not necessarily around banking and mis-selling products, but it's the same sort of trade-offs and goal conflicts that we see in safety or quality or whatever else it might be.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm just diverging from the safety path at the moment because I'm just genuinely curious. Around about that time when there was the, I don't know, global financial crisis, we'll call it. How bad was it for Barclays and the people who worked there? We were kind of insulated a little bit from it in Australia.
Yeah, so it was an interesting time. Now, when I guess technically there was the early tremors of the GFC and then there was the full-blown event. When I was at Barclays, it was still the very early parts of it, 2007-8, where we'd had the Northern Rock collapse. Building society called Northern Rock in the UK collapsed, and that's saved. But then it all went a bit quiet for a while. It was obviously things were bubbling away underneath. But then I moved from Barclays to NatWest, as is now as the RBS group then, which at the time was the, little did I realize, was the biggest bank in the world and had the largest balance sheet in the world and was one of the worst leveraged banks to the all of the subprime and various other different issues that were going on in the world at the time. So yeah, it was like going from the saucepan into the fire, to be honest with you, because it was a far worse position to be in. But I hadn't kind of realized that when I made the move up to NatWest. But yeah, that was really quite horrendous. And some of the things that you saw up close, like many people who work in a bank aren't these rolling, filthy rich investment bankers who we like to think of as being, you know, these terrible bankers. They were making massive bonuses and phenomenal amount of money. Most of my colleagues who worked in business banking, they'd worked for the bank, some of them since they'd left school or left university. They'd worked their way through the system. You know, they were in good positions, but they'd done the right things. They felt it. They'd invested their bonuses in the share scheme and kind of really invested their career in the bank. And then when you see the share price go from £5 a share to 10 pence, in the space of about 2 or 3 months, those people have lost almost everything that they'd saved. And that's heartbreaking when you see people who have put a 20 or 30 year career in a decent job, but not like an investment banker flying around in a private jet and all the rest of it, you know, Wolf of Wall Street style. They were some of the people who were, you know, use Decker's terms, second victims. They were as much victims of what had happened in the GFC as their customers and other investors who were not involved in the bank. So it was a lot of collateral damage all around. And there's only really a very small number of people at the very top of the bank who were been making absolutely wild and ridiculous, risky moves for vast personal benefit in the short term, but incredible damage to not just the banking industry, but the whole economy in the UK at that time.
Yeah. That's good, because I've never had an insight into how bad it actually got. And I was just curious, because it was one of those big historical things at the time.
It was a story to share from that time. I remember a businessman coming to see me, because I was his bank manager. This was in late 2008, maybe early 2009.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And this man came and sat down in my office and said, "I'm absolutely desperate. I'm about to lose my house. I've already lost the business. Is there anything you can do for me?" And I'm just looking at the screen, and it's like, you just know it's right. It's a no. But you're always in this position where you're thinking, I even actually don't care about the bank at this point in time. If there was something I could do to help this guy out, I would. Because the guy that she said to me, I said, "I've tried everything. I said, I've cried more, you know, but it's not helping me." He said, "But if there's anything at all you can do." And as a young professional who was in this position, I felt completely unqualified to be able to deal with a situation like that. Really was in a position to be able to help. And I just felt really quite helpless, actually, and thinking, man, how do you deal with that? And that wasn't that an unusual occurrence at that time, as lots of small businesses were going down the gurgler, so to speak. There really wasn't very much that we could do for those types of businesses. So yeah, it was a difficult time, and I was glad to be out of it when I came out from the UK to Australia.
Yeah. It's probably unfair to ask this, but is it, in your opinion, destined to happen again?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't got a crystal ball, and I don't know enough about how the banks are operating now. They'd like to say that a lot of the regulations that were put in place after the GFC would prevent a similar sort of event. And the major banks certainly are better capitalized now than they were back then. But who knows? You can never say never about anything, right?
That's right. All right. Switching back to safety. What are the benefits for HOP being introduced to a business of any size?
That's a good question, and it really depends on where an organization's starting from, to be honest with you. Sometimes I feel like it's a bit of a weaselly kind of answer, but I often get asked questions, and the answer is often, well, it depends, because it depends on the context, and it depends where you're at. But one of the most common things we see is for organizations who really engage with these principles or this kind of operating philosophy, one of the things we always see is an improvement in engagement as a starting point. And once you've got improved engagement, there's any number of different things you can do with that, right? So we always see that as an early benefit. And then obviously learning and insight, like the whole approach is geared to, well, creating the conditions so we then get better at learning about what's really going on. And again, if you're doing better learning, you've almost got no excuse not to be improving, because you've got an insight into what's really happening, what the challenges are. And you know that maybe that initiative you were planning to improve safety, well, maybe that's not going to cut it once you realize what the real issues are, and the poster campaign or the next toolbox talk isn't going to make that any better. So I think there are two of the things that we don't make any promises, but these are two of the things you're very likely to experience. And then beyond that, well, who knows where you're going to take that.
Yeah, I agree. Do you find some businesses are still very much command and control type situations?
Yes, some more than others, and it seems to vary from industry to industry, and even and country to country as well. We've been traveling around a lot over the last 18 months, particularly going to lots of different countries. It's fascinating to, because we talk so much, we have talked so much about culture in the past in safety. I think one of the really critical aspects of culture which gets overlooked is the difference in national cultures.
Mm.
We talk about these various different theories and approaches as if they're going to be universal in terms of they'll apply this anywhere and it'll just work the same. Of course it will. And it's like, well, we've just been in the last few months to Chile, the Philippines and Bahrain, just as three examples. Well, the cultures in each of those countries is really very, very different. And one of those countries that I can see that both the people in the course and myself were all having this realization as we're sat there thinking, this is going to be really challenging to do in this environment. And there's no two ways of, you know, you can want it and wish it and will it all you want. But in some places, it's going to be a real uphill struggle because you're working against a national culture, which is very hierarchical by, you know, and has been that way for centuries. So you're not going to overturn that with a little bit of like, oh, this is our new approach. This is how we're going to do things. And we're going to get better at talking to our people and listening to them. Sometimes that's just so opposed to the norms. It's a real challenge.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of situations where it's a bit, you would think it's one way, but it's not the other way. Now, Japan is a traditional country with traditional values and that, but they're very much on board with listening to the workers for improvements, aren't they?
They are. Japan's an interesting one because, of course, they've got the culture of continual improvement, and there was like no country really that took Deming's ideas to heart more than Japan. And I think that's the key point, is that they really, in HOP language, they saw it as an operating philosophy, not a program, which is one of the reasons why like TQM and the Toyota production system, lots of failed in America and other places, but worked phenomenally well in Japan. But at the same time, Japan also is still, despite that, still has some quite hierarchical tendencies. And there's other aspects of their culture which probably not so helpful. Things like never leaving before the boss, for argument's sake, and the incredible working hours that are the norm there, and the kind of not challenging and things like that. So I don't think there's differences and nuances in almost every culture, right? You can never find one and say, oh, that culture is perfectly aligned to these principles or perfectly not aligned to these principles.
Yeah, and aviation is again a curious one for me, because again, you would think very hierarchical, very structured, where you've had senior pilots that have built up thousands and thousands of hours, et cetera, the junior pilots, but they've been ones that have embraced this whole ideas and taken them on board almost the most.
They haven't, they haven't.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, aviation are, in many respects, are a very advanced, and aviation obviously believes it's very, very advanced, but where I see that the difference is now is that other industries have maybe taken on more, maybe what we might call newer approaches and theories, and aviation now is, for the most part, still very much sticking to its guns in terms of, no, we've got this all worked out. We've got SMS, we've got Just Culture. We kind of, and we're also pretty good as well. You know, we're a very safe industry. So whilst one of the things that we've found is some parts of the aviation industry are quite impervious to change, because it feels like, well, you know, we've got to the pinnacle in some respects. I'm seeing that slowly changing, but that has been part of my experience. But I guess in terms of the compelling case for change, does aviation have one? Because it is already, for some people's reasoning, it feels like, well, it's incredibly safe, which of course by any any reasonable person's assessment, if you look at the statistics, it's a very, very safe way of getting around, and it's particularly in high capacity RPT, it's a safe way of operating. So, but again, it's, as I said before, it's not about stopping all the things that they've been doing up until now, but maybe some things are less helpful. But it is about complementing the things they're already doing with some new approaches, I guess.
Yeah, just on that, I'll just ask your opinion. Quite often we get thrown around these term high reliability organizations, and airlines are sometimes considered in that. Some military operations or apparatus are considered in that too. Yeah, are they reality?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? That I remember having a conversation with a head of safety for a large airline. I'll just say that. And he made a comment to me. He said, "Our goal is to be a high reliability organization." And I had so many questions after that point in time after he made that statement. I thought, well, what do you actually mean by that statement? Because by almost any definition based on outcomes, you already are a highly reliable organization, because this is a major airline flying millions of people a year, doing that to a really quite reliable, particularly at this point pre-COVID. You think, well, by any almost by any measure, it was a high reliability organization. So are you referring to high reliability by outcome, or are you referring to high reliability as like it's a particular set of traits that we want to develop? And I think that's one of the For me, it's always been an interesting thing about HRO theory. Although maybe you could say argue it's the original New View approach, wanting to take a different way of thinking about or conceptualizing what safety is. I've heard the term bandied around by people and thought, I'm not sure if you're actually entirely sure what you mean. Are you talking about an outcome, or are you talking about something which you're going to be doing in order to achieve those outcomes? So I think it depends on what you mean by the term, whether it really exists or not.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's good. I just remember touching on a subject with Professor Hopkins, and he was of the opinion that they don't really exist in real life. And I was like, okay, you deal with aviation, I'll put it to you. Okay. Now, one of the things that Southpac is known for across Australia is that you bring out some absolutely marvelous speakers. Absolutely marvelous speakers. And I'll be quite honest, whenever you do, I'm usually working and I don't get time off to go and do it. But I've got to ask you, how do you get such marvelous speakers to travel all the way around the world? And why do you do it?
It's a good question, actually. I guess one of the advantages of owning and running your own business is you can do things which maybe you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So I first, for example, Bob Edwards, I first came across Bob on a podcast like 7 years ago, I think, 6 or 7 years ago. I just really liked the sound of what Bob was talking about. And he was the first person I ever heard talk about learning teams. And I thought, this sounds really practical. It sounds interesting. I'm really curious about this. So I just got in touch. I still remember the day. I was in Tasmania. I was down there for an audit, and I was walking along across the Nut in Stanley, listening to this podcast. And I thought, as soon as I get back to the room, I'm going to email this guy. And just said to him, "Hey, would you be interested in coming out to Australia? Really liked what you were just talking about. Would you be interested in coming out here, and we could put on a workshop, and I put my people through it and see what other interests there is out there?" And that just kind of planted the seed, I guess. And then we got into a habit then of fairly regularly bringing out different people who had things we thought were valuable and worth learning from. It became a fairly steady drumbeat of people we were bringing out, again, before COVID. And then COVID was the great disruptor, right? And for better or for worse. And one of the things we kind of got out of the habit of doing was bringing out so many great people to it. But we have got plans next year for a few new events. And of course, Bob's coming back as well. We bring back Bob every 9 months or so. So, but it's, yeah, it started out, I guess it was a little bit of a hobby, to be honest with you. Different people, I read the book or I'd heard some talking and thought, that'd be really interesting to get out here, see if they'll want to run a workshop for us. And that's how it kind of started. But yeah, it's fun.
Good. What sort of programs does South Pack run in terms of HOP and new viewer safety for businesses?
Yeah, so there's the courses we run around the country on a public basis, which are happening, on a pretty regular basis, where it's like the people are just interested in the kind of fundamentals of what's this all about. We have a course around that. And then the thing that we've kind of, I guess, made our name on has been the teaching of learning teams and how to run learning teams. So I think we ran our first ever course back in 2017, and have been bouncing around all over the place ever since in that space. So yeah, learning teams, HOP integration. And we've got a new tool which is just about to be released, an event learning review, which kind of goes hand in hand with learning teams. So that's something we're pretty excited about. Developed with a client, and it's worked really quite nicely. So one of the things we've kind of, I guess, always known, but especially have learned, learning teams don't work in all situations. It's not, it's has to be, again, it's got to be context dependent. It's got to be the right setting. It's got to be the right type of event, and have the right people available. There are times when it's a learning team just isn't going to get you the best outcome and isn't going to be the right tool to use. So it's like, what do you use in those other instances? So that's one of the kind of the gaps that we've aimed to fill with the event learning review.
Okay, a couple of questions before I go, and oh no, maybe one will put you on the spot. In safety, you'd be aware that there are a lot of people, I call them the bean counters. So, the ones that love to measure things. They love to measure outcomes, count things, et cetera, et cetera. HOP's been around for, I don't know, you talked about 2015. Learning teams, well, they've been around for a few years. Are there any measurable outcomes to show why businesses should adopt it? Does this result in, for those who love to measure things, reduction in incidents, accidents, near misses, lost time injuries, all those wonderful things?
Potentially, and that's a really weak answer. We have some clients, for argument's sake, who after 2 years of engaging with HOP and learning teams, they looked at their stats and they said, okay, after 2 years, we have seen their LTIFR had dropped a little bit, but severity had dropped significantly, which was good. Their work cover costs had declined by hundreds of thousands of dollars a year as a consequence. That was two kind of data points. Their retention had improved because they had had problems around blaming and punishing and so on. But I think for me, one of the most interesting things was in their annual engagement survey for 2 years in a row, they'd improved in so much so that safety had gone from being the worst performing part of the business to being the best performing part of the business over that 2 years. Now, you'd argue, well, that's not really empirical evidence, no experiment. How do you know it was the HOP and the learning teams piece which changed the that changed the was responsible for those changes? And I think that's one of the challenges we'll always have. It's like, in economics, you talk about ceteris paribus, all the things being equal, you do this thing and you do this thing, this is what you're going to get. But the reality is ceteris paribus doesn't exist. Nothing ever stays all the things remaining equal, right? There's all manner of other things going on in an organization. So it ends up looking very much like a correlational thing that, well, this is what they did. They changed. They were working with these principles, they were introducing this. These are the major changes they've made, and these are the things they've seen as a consequence. So, yes, I think that there are measurable improvements that can be gained from doing these things. But the measurement part is I'll be honest, it's the least inspiring or least interesting part of the conversation, but it inevitably always comes up every single course. Okay, how do we measure this? It's like, oh, crying out loud. I understand why people ask the question. Every MBA program globally teaches people about the importance of KPIs and metrics. But to me, it seems like almost like it's in a cast iron rule. Almost anything that you put a measure on, whether it's lagging or leading or whatever, almost inevitably has more negative consequences associated with it, unintended consequences, than positive. And no matter what you do, it always ends up seeming to lead to some kind of gamification of like, what do we need to do in order to make the numbers look good? So I'm very cautious around getting involved in measures conversations. I tend to say, well, my bias tends to be careful, be cautious. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Rather than saying what they should be putting in place, it's I'm generally always an advocate for, well, maybe you need to be measuring less rather than more.
Yeah, good. Good. All right. Actually, I've got a couple more questions for you. But one came up to me. Queensland government is in the process of introducing changes to its Work Health and Safety Act as we speak. And there's some interesting things in there. Do you think that for most businesses, having tougher pe financial penalties or even jail time actually makes any difference in day-to-day decision making for frontline leaders?
I've got to be honest that I don't know what the research is on this, but my personal opinion is I think the whole thing is a gimmick. I think industrial manslaughter is, it's a gimmick, and it's a case of it's window dressing, and it's look how serious we are about safety, and look how serious we are about being tough on these nasty corporations. I don't see what it's going to improve, but what I do see is a whole lot of unintended consequences that are going to flow on from this. And it's going to be more of the same of what we've already got in terms of more defensive behaviors, more bureaucracy, more things that we know don't improve safety, but are going to give people a sense of comfort in terms of saying, oh, well, we've done this, at least we've done that, and we've covered ourselves on this. And that I just think is really frustrating. I tell a story about a mine site I had to go to not so long ago, and how I ended up having doing not one, but 2 6-hour online inductions just to be able to get on the airplane, one for the mine operator and one for the mine owner. And I think to yourself, who's this helping? And it all that kind of legislation, in my opinion, seems to drive is more of that kind of defensive sort of behavior. It's not helpful. I think we know it's not going to, deep down, we think we all know it's not going to improve safety outcomes. It's not going to improve decision making at the front line. Let's face it. Who's really thinking about industrial manslaughter consequences at, in a supervisory position? In my experience, that's not something people are cognizant of while they're, in the nuts and bolts and the weeds of getting work done. I think where it does have an impact is in boardrooms and senior leadership levels, who, particularly when consultants come along and say, oh, you better do this, otherwise you could go to jail. Which is, let's face it, we've all heard that being used, and I think it's a terrible motivator. So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the changes.
Good, good. If you ever want to talk about pointless induction processes, that's something I could talk to you about for hours. That's a different subject. All right. Lastly, the last question I have for you is it frustrating for you that you can have a safety manager or a CEO who is on board with introducing HOP learning teams into the business? The business takes it on, embraces it, does well. But then the position changes. Someone new comes in with a slightly different point of view, and we're literally only one step away from going 5 to 10 years back in the way we see safety.
Yeah, I think that's always a concern, but I think I just spend quite a bit of time talking about that with clients. This and the problem is, if it's seen as a fad and the latest program, that's almost going to be an inevitable consequence, that the people who introduced the fad or the latest program, if they would move on, the thing falls over in a heap. And we've already seen that play out in various different organizations. So it's got to go deeper than just being a fad or a program. It's got to be seen as a more of a fundamental shift in attitude around safety. I look at an organization like Mitchell Services and the work that Josh and his team have done there. That's what they're one of the examples I point to and say, listen, that's 5 or 6 years. This isn't something, it's been an overnight thing. Oh, we're rolling this out and we're doing this now. It's been a fundamental shift in how they approach safety, how they work with their people, how they treat their people, how they, it's a root and branch kind of, not to say every root and branch has had to be changed, but every root and branch has had to be looked at to consider, well, how do we do this in alignment with these sorts of principles? And that's a, some organizations, face it, don't want to hear that message. Oh, 5 or 6 years. No, I want something much quicker than that. So, yeah. So I think, yes, it is frustrating, but I think in my experience, an organization who's just looking for the latest fad or program, they're not necessarily the organizations you want to be working with anyway, because it just becomes very frustrating. Even from early doors, you're like, oh, okay, this isn't going to be a great success, because there's a lot of lip service being paid right from the outset, and you think, yeah, this is going to be hard work.
Andy, Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today, and I really do appreciate your time, and I really look forward to actually speaking to you again soon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Tom. Look forward to seeing you next time in Perth.
Thanks for listening to Health and Safety Conversations with Tom Bourne. Until next time, stay safe and enjoy the rest of your week.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.